Welcome to the Monster Club, an honest look at horror movies from lifelong horror fans. Fair warning, you may not have seen this movie. We have spoilers, ho! I am Jethel Silverwing.
And I'm Doc.
This week, we go head-to-head with another double feature. We're looking at The Thing.
And the other thing.
That's right. We're going head-to-head, 1982 John Carpenter's The Thing, and we'll compare and review and take a look back at the 2011 prequel, The Thing.
Mm-hmm. Not a remake.
Not a remake. A prequel. Alternate titles! Go!
Anti-Vaxxers, A Horror Story.
Because I like
really,
that one.
These two movies, it's really an allegory about the importance of getting your fucking shots, people. I mean, this is what happens when you don't get vaccinated. Somebody gets infected, then another person, then everybody's infected, and you don't know who's safe to be around and who's not, and then everybody's dead. So,
all right,
go
then
to your doctor and get your flu shot, please.
Okay, no, I actually have two titles, and they're both for tourist videos.
Okay.
Tourism videos.
Mm-hmm.
1982. Come to Norway! You just might learn something that'll save your life.
Norway? They're in Antarctica.
Yes, but they're Norwegian, and they're shouting a warning in Norwegian to the Americans.
Oh, okay. Or maybe you could make it an advertisement for Rosetta Stone.
Oh, there you go. And for the 2011 movie, Antarctic Flamethrowers, failing you just when you need them most.
You know, they don't actually take flamethrowers down to Antarctica.
Oh, I know, but the flamethrower is just the standard horror movie kill-everything thing, you know?
And it's weird. They really can't justify having them, but they're there. I mean, I guess when I was a kid watching this movie, I kind of rationalized it saying, well, I guess that's how they burn up trash. But that wouldn't be allowed legally, would it? You couldn't incinerate trash in Antarctica. That would be like polluting the pristine wilderness there.
Okay, now on to The Thing.
And the other thing.
All
and
right.
Actually, another thing.
And another thing?
That's right. The 1982 film from John Carpenter.
Oh, that's right. That was actually a remake of a 1950s movie.
Yeah. 30 years later, A Thing from Another World. How cool is that?
Mm-hmm.
Have you ever seen it?
No, I can't say I have.
I have. It is, if you really love these two movies, The Thing from Another World is worth going back to look at because there are so many homages in both films that refer back to this classic 1950s film. The monster in it is a big guy in a suit. Scary alien, you know, with, mysterious powers and whatnot. And it's not the shape changer of the original Who Goes There short story. By John W. Campbell that was written in the 30s that this whole thing is based on. But it is still really cool to watch this old black and white movie and see, oh, that's where they got that from. And there are callbacks to it throughout both films. And it's fascinating to watch all three together. That's cool.
It is not on Netflix. I'll have to see if I can find it somewhere. All right, so.
Yeah.
The Thing. Of course, the 1982 is a classic sci-horror from John Carpenter.
Yeah, it's actually known as John Carpenter's The Thing. I guess that's how they felt they could get away with naming the new one in 2011, The Thing.
The Thing. And, oh, God. I love The Thing. I always have. It's one of the first sci-horrors I ever saw.
How excited were you when the 2011 movie was announced?
Oh, God.
I was beside myself. I was just like, yes, yes, yes.
I took this, oh, God, what are they going to do with this?
There's always that little bit of, you know, but I fight against that. I fight against that because I want to go in, I want to give it the best possible chance. You know, and if I have to do a little suspension of disbelief or, You know, I want to go into a movie with an open mind. I try not to get too hyped about something, but I definitely don't want to get pessimistic about it going into it, because I figure you only have the chance to watch something for the first time once in your whole life.
True.
And then it's done. And if you go in there with a pissy attitude and you start picking it apart and pointing out all the errors and mistakes and things that could have been done, and you don't like this actor, and you've ruined it. You pissed in your popcorn. You pissed in your own popcorn. So it's really important to me to kind of strike a happy medium there. Don't get too hyped about it, but be ready. Give it that chance, that opening, that opportunity to amaze you. So I was excited for the 2011 film, and I was not disappointed.
Well, when I first heard the announcement, I thought it was just going to be another remake, because, you know, everything's a remake nowadays. Well,
that was my initial thought, but then when I heard it was a prequel and they were going to set up things that, you know, happened before the movie, I was like, yes, that's perfect.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly what should be done. I want to know about the other camp, the Norwegians. So right, that's exactly what they did.
Okay, so let's give an overall look at both movies. So what's happened here?
Yeah, it's really a story.
Basically, the story starts with the 2011 prequel.
That's right.
An alien ship has crash landed on Earth hundreds of thousands of years in the past.
Well, 100,000. They say the ice that it's contained in is about 100,000 years old.
Okay, so 100,000 years ago, the spaceship crash lands on Earth. Something crawls out of it and basically freezes in the ice, about 20 feet away from the crash site. Of course, this is Antarctica. So, okay, that's completely realistic. You're going to freeze to death if you're not protected out there.
Mm-hmm.
Now, come to 1982, at least movie time, that is. The story was written back in the 30s.
Mm-hmm.
But 1982, a Norwegian research camp.
A Norwegian Antarctic scientific research station.
Right. They come across the spaceship. Well, what is it? They were skidooing or something like that and fell through the ice and found it, and then they started
They were driving their, I don't know, what did you say skidoo? It's a truck built it for Arctic weathering, and they were following some sort of radio signal.
Ah, gotcha.
The ping from the... They don't know what it was.
And they fall through the ice into a cavern where they find the spaceship.
That's right.
Then they decide to excavate it. And then during the excavation process, about 20 yards away or something like that, they find the thing frozen in ice. So they pull the thing out of the ice in a big block and bring it back to their camp. Now let's talk about the great scientific minds and techniques that go into collecting a tissue sample from this fucking...
I've seen the movies several times, and I always watch them together, and I decided, you know what, I'm going to listen to the commentary tracks for these movies this viewing through.
I have not
seen
that.
They said that's pretty much how you do it. You take a hand drill and you drill down into the tissue and then you pull tissue out. That is exactly how you do it.
Really?
When you're excavating, yeah, they said that turns out to be the simplest way to get a tissue sample.
Also, so it is completely accurate. Also, the simplest way to wreck your sample.
Well, I mean, it's going to decompose anyway.
Well,
you know, and you know that, or it's going to stay frozen. And you're going to need to take a tissue sample anyway. And if it's frozen, it's not like it's going to fall apart if you take a chunk out of it.
True.
So
they have power drill. And
that's
drill,
right.
Drill, drill, drill. Crunch, fall through. Oh, shit.
It's a great scene.
And the look of oops on their face is like, well, here's your tissue sample.
And of course, this isn't a woolly mammoth or anything. This is potentially a creature from beyond our world. So perhaps they could have taken a little bit more care, but there was urgency. They had to know right away. So that was really important that they get this tissue sample and look at it under a freaking microscope ASAP. Because of the potential for that discovery. I mean, can you imagine if that really happened?
Oh yeah.
Wow.
Now, in the scientific exploration of what this thing is, in the examination, we have to make note of the number one sin of prequels.
Mm.
Your technology from your prequel cannot be greater than the technology from the original.
You know, okay, but in the 1982 movie, they have this scene that's really laughable. It's forgivable because it was 1982, but they have the only medically trained person, the doc, the medical guy, and he's looking at this computer screen, and you see this 1980s Asteroids graphics.
Pretty much.
Showing.
It really did look like Asteroids, didn't it?
Yeah, yeah, or they actually worse. Said that in the commentary.
Wait, not Asteroids, the Atari version of Asteroids.
Yeah, exactly. And this was like about a frame every, you know, 2 seconds.
Right.
Just to give you an idea, it's all pixel and no detail whatsoever.
In the prequel, it's very smooth, very detailed.
Right, but that's actually her looking straight at the sample through the microscope. That's right. Not a computer graphics on a screen somewhere. That's just her looking right at the sample through the lens. So you're actually seeing not a representation, but the cells themselves there. That's my understanding, the way the scene played out.
Right.
So yeah, I forgave them for that reason. And of course, the reason they did the computer graphics thing in the 1980s movie was they didn't have the technology to do the cell. She's just looking through a regular microscope.
Right.
Apparently a very powerful one.
Yeah, to see cells like that. But continue with we're just talking the over. All over story. So thing replicates other things. And kills and stuff like that. At the very end, the only thing left really is like 2 people, a helicopter, and a dog. And they're chasing the dog across the tundra, and they go to the American camp, where an American is accidentally shot by the Norwegian, who is shouting what we now know is a warning. And we'll talk about that in a little bit.
You know, he wasn't actually speaking Norwegian. He was just kind of making it up. It was just, you know, one of the crew. I can't remember if it was a producer or somebody, an editor. I can't remember, but he just kind of made it up. But they did actual Norwegian to play the role that led into that, though. They had to get somebody that looked kind of like him.
So then we have the dog shacking up with the Americans. Dog turns out to be the thing again.
Well, laying aside the details of the overarching details of the story, this is a isolation story. You have a group of people trapped in an isolated setting, and a creature is basically possessing them. It eats you, and then it replicates you perfectly. Mm-hmm. Down to the cellular level, and even consumes the knowledge of your brain. And so it can replicate your personality, your knowledge, everything it wants to. That is the most insidious invader. And the whole the neat thing about these two films is the viewer is not made aware, is not given all the information they need to know exactly who has been infected. Who has been replicated and taken over. So it's this game of who's it? You know, who is the thing?
Who goes there?
How many of these characters are still human? Exactly. Who goes there? And it's great because they're trapped there. They're cut off. Communication is cut off. You know, it's important that this takes place in the 1980s still. I'm glad they didn't do a 20 years later kind of thing.
Yeah, you really can't because
now you got satellite phones.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, Antarctica, okay, maybe weather could block out communications, but not for long.
Right.
You know, so...
You know, it's almost like they said in the Blair Witch Project. It's very hard, actually, to get lost nowadays.
Yeah, it is. I mean, you lose your cell phone, that would be the thing that would have to happen, wouldn't it?
Yeah. Or in this case, your satellite phone, because no cell phone's going to work in Antarctica.
Right.
You actually have to have a military-issue satellite phone. But it's hard to lose contact with the outside world nowadays. So
and they even made extra special care to take care of that. In both movies, they kind of sabotaged, you know, the vehicles and the communication equipment so that this thing couldn't use those things to get out to civilization and infect the rest of the world. And that's the stakes here. These people have come to realize that if this thing gets off of Antarctica, humanity's done.
Yep.
I think the estimate was, I think I worked it out to just over 3 years. The entire population of the planet would be infected,
something like that, yeah.
And there would be no humans left. So that's pretty high stakes. That's pretty high stakes. Pretty scary, too, the way it happens. It's not like, you know, ooh, it touches you and then you're infected. Whatever it's imitating rips itself apart and all these tentacles come out and rip you apart pretty much and consume you alive and then produce a replica of you.
Okay, so that is an overall look at the story.
Yeah.
That we're talking about. It's isolation, paranoia, distrust. Okay, so, all right, let's take the good, the bad, and the ugly of both of these movies.
Mm.
Okay, let's, just so we can stay focused, let's start with the 1982.
The thing.
The good, the bad, and the ugly. The good, all good actors as far as I'm concerned.
An excellent ensemble cast. And I think they made the right choice in making all male actors, too, because that was a rare thing. To not have some sort of stupid love interest thing going on somewhere. All male cast, there's no posturing, you know, to impress the girl or the girls. So I just like that.
And in some horror situations, a female is there to distract the guy long enough to get killed.
Right, because everybody knows that sex means death.
No, not only about sex. It's we must protect the women. Men are
circle the wagons, right?
Men instinctively, and this is not Hollywood make-believe or anything, men instinctively will protect the woman, whether she needs it or not.
Mm-hmm.
That is drilled into us. That is nature. We feel we have to protect the female. And so, that gets us killed more often than not in horror movies.
That's right.
Okay. The only weak link, I think, in the cast, Wilford Brimley.
Really?
Oh, God.
Quaker Oats guy? Seriously? Is that who we're talking about? Quaker Oats guy.
I think that's Wilford Brimley. But,
We're talking about the guy who says, with the glasses, and he's smashing up the radio room, and he says, they want to be us!
If there was a weak link in the cast, it was Wilford Brimley.
I could not disagree more. He's one of my favorite. Yeah, you wanted disagreements. And
your
here
favorite
it is.
Old coot.
He is one of my favorite characters in the classic film because he's so genuine. His reactions to everything as he's cutting these grotesque corpses apart, these things, you know, on the autopsy table.
I read something very interesting on the autopsy scenes.
What's that?
In the autopsy scene, he was really the only one coughing and kind of gagging a little bit in the scenes. But behind the scenes, he was the only one not grossed out by the autopsy scene.
Well,
because
the coughing was from the special effects smoke. They used a very acrid, this is what they had at the time, a very acrid, you know, effects smoke. And he's, you know, coughing and he's like playing it off like, oh my God, this is so disgusting. you know, it must be rotten, but it doesn't make any sense because it's out in the cold and it's been frozen. Yeah. So it couldn't possibly have gone off, but he's coughing because of the effect smoke. But really, yeah, he's a kind of a country doctor, isn't he?
Yeah, he's a country doctor. He's seen it all.
Yeah. So he really, when he's pulling the guts out of this sculpture, they made this sculpture and then they wrapped it in kind of a rubber latex outer fleshy coating.
Right.
And then they put real, you know, I'm assuming
real, they were
cow
real,
organs.
There were real animal organs he was pulling out of that.
He was pulling out intestine and lungs and a heart. And he was really, you know, it looked authentic and it really was.
It really was. Those were real organs.
And I love how he sold it. And I love the way he goes nuts later. That scene where they locked him out in the shed and they go to check on him. And they open up the little view thing, and he's got the hangman's noose. And he's like, I want to come back inside. I'm all right now. I wasn't before, but I'm all right now, and I really want to come back inside. You got to listen to me. Come on. He's trying to be reasonable, and he's got this noose there.
That is ridiculous, though. Is it? I'm all right now, really. I'm not going to use this thing.
And I love his lines, and I love the way he says, they want to be us. You know, and he's one of my favorite characters. The only character that I didn't feel was made much use of was I can't remember his name now, but the one that's always toking up, the other helicopter pilot. Yeah, he's
Windows.
Well, was it Windows? Windows was the radio operator. I'm thinking of the other helicopter pilot who says, hey, I'll take you up. And the commander's like, no, I don't think so. You know, because he was toking up right there. You know.
I can't remember his name either.
Yeah. He was killed off pretty quickly. And
for you geeks out there, yes, there are characters named Mac and Windows in this movie.
Yeah.
But, of course, this is 1982, so it didn't mean anything.
He was the only weak link, I thought. But still, he was okay as a background character, you know?
We'll have to agree to disagree on that.
So who was your favorite character in the original 1980 movie?
Oh, MacReady, by far.
Well, yeah, but aside from him, I mean, he's the obvious. He's the hero and everything.
How about the black cook?
Yeah, I was going to say that, too.
Who's
Mr. Roller Skates?
He's roller skating around and...
And he's awesome. Love that when the guy says, hey, could you turn that crap down? I've been shot today. And he goes, sure thing, man. And he goes skating by the radio, and he just kind of makes a motion of turning it down, but he doesn't actually touch the radio. He's like, I gave it a shot. Fuck him. He just keeps on jamming
very
away.
Superstitious.
I just love his attitude, you know?
Yeah.
I love his attitude. He's just so I loved how genuine this group of actors was. There was a lot of camaraderie, I think. It seemed like everybody just kind of got along, you know?
Yep.
And it shows in the film. It really shows. And I like how different they are. So that you stand a chance of kind of knowing who's who by the time everybody parkas up and puts on their goggles, and it gets hard to tell the difference between them, you know?
Yeah, there's not a lot of character development in this, but the short bit of time that they do put into it is just enough for you to feel for these characters.
Oh, and you know who else I like? I like the guy that takes care of the dogs. I can't remember his name. But
Blake.
You know who I'm talking about. Is that his name?
The character's name was Blake, I believe.
I don't see it.
Let's
there.
See. Blake. Was it Blake?
I see Clark.
Maybe it was Clark.
Yeah, it was Clark. I see his
yes,
face.
Yes, Clark.
So he's Richard just Masher. Kind of like this. And he actually said that he requested that part because it interested him, because he's like the loner and he's more connecting with the dogs than mm-hmm. with the other people around him. And I really kind of liked him and the way he against all reason tries to prevent MacReady and the other guy from firing on the dogs as they're being consumed by this thing in the kennel. So those are my favorite characters, absolutely.
So speaking of dogs being consumed in the kennel, let's talk about phenomenal practical effects.
I know, holy heck.
This is before computer, before they even dreamt about computer CGI. I mean, the majority of CGI you saw in any movie back then was, like we discussed earlier, the cell animation, you know, for what they saw in the microscope.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, just animated that, pixels.
And that was pretty laughable.
That was laughable. But phenomenal practical effects in this movie.
Okay, most of the special creature effects were designed and created by Rob Botten and his crew, with the exception of the dog creature, which was created by Stan Winston.
Stan Winston right up there with Rick Baker.
Mm-hmm.
As far as creature special effects. But Stan went uncredited because he wanted the other guy to get all the credit, you know, not take away from his work. He voluntarily went uncredited in this movie.
Mm-hmm. And he was young, too. He was like in his early 20s when this was put together. Mm-hmm. Just a kid. And it was a really big deal for him. He was ecstatic. You know, Rob Botten, if I'm thinking this is the same guy from the I'm blanking on the word now. The commentary track on the Blu-ray that I watched. He spent over a year there at the studios, 7 days a week, sleeping at the studios, working mm-hmm. on this film.
Yep, I read that.
He worked himself sick. He actually had to go to the hospital because he worked himself so much. And there was no other time in his life when he could have possibly done that. If anybody tried that in their 30s or 40s, they'd end up dead.
Yep.
He worked himself silly, and the director said, "Hey, you know, you're not looking so good. You are going to the hospital." I can't imagine working that much on anything. But it certainly shows, because holy heck. I mean, all before, you know, CGI was a thing, which is kind of necessitated these days by production schedules, even if you want to do all practical. It was incredible, the stuff that he did.
Oh, yeah. For the time, I was like, oh, my God. Rob Barton, of course, also did effects on The Howling.
Mm-hmm. He came from doing The Howling to do this, I think. It was his previous.
Yep, The Howling, The Thing, Legend,
mm-hmm.
RoboCop, Total Recall, Seven, Fight Club, and one episode of Game of Thrones.
Wow, really? Yep. What did he do for Game of Thrones?
Let's see here. It says here the episode The Lion and the Rose. He did special effects makeup on that one. I'm not sure which episode that is off the top of my head.
Interesting. Cool. So he's made a career out of this. And I always really admired those guys. When I was younger, I had, you know, the idea that I was going to become one of these guys, you know, making spaceships or, you know, prosthetics or, mm-hmm. you know, animatronics or something, puppets and whatnot, because I really liked the way practical creature effects move.
Yes.
If they could replicate that in CGI flawlessly.
Yeah, we talked about this last time with The Howling and American Werewolf in London. There's just some things that practical effects do that are just so much more realistic.
It's not necessarily realistic, but there's just something organic about the way it moves and jiggles
mm-hmm.
where it's actual musculature moving it. Even if it looks a little bit fake because you know it's a puppet or something, there's just something kind of cool about it that CGI doesn't have. Nice. It moves, CGI moves too fluidly and perfectly.
Yeah. Now, there's only one scene where there's any stop motion, and that's at the end of the 1982 movie when the giant tentacles burst out of the ground
mm-hmm.
and grab the dynamite detonator.
Right.
That's the only bit of stop motion.
Mm-hmm. I specifically remember seeing that scene when I was a kid, staying up way too late, secretly watching HBO or something on our premium cable. That was a really impressive scene that really stayed with me. stop motion claymation aside, it looks pretty good. It was a pretty damn good miniature. The Blu-ray unfortunately lacks a lot of the behind the scenes stuff that they, you know, the documentaries that they put together for the DVD. And I, somewhere I have the DVD release of this movie. And, that's worth getting, even if you have the Blu-ray, because they have all kinds of, behind the scenes, and they show, you know, this model set for the basement, which is basically a huge room dug out in the ice that the base was then built up, you know, upon,
right,
ostensibly. And is also the location of my favorite line from the movie. Can you guess what it is, Jethel?
No.
It's the scene where the commander is goes to check out the generator to see what's up. And he says, "The generator's gone. Can you fix it?" MacReady says,
"It's gone."
"It's gone, MacReady." And he's looking at the generator, is just gone, because the thing took it apart to build its little flying saucer nearby through one of the tunnels.
Okay, so good acting, great special effects. The story I thought was awesome. Well, let's take a look at some of the bad moments.
Okay. I can't think of any.
Okay.
Well, I can think of some of these. Some of the creatures were a little hokey. One in particular.
I wasn't even talking about hokey creatures, but you go ahead. Go ahead.
Okay. So the biggest flaw in the film to me visually was the one where Windows gets eaten up by the creature springing from the other character, Potsmoker's head, when it splits open and grabs him like a big Venus flytrap.
Oh, yeah.
And then just kind of whips his obviously stuffed scarecrow body around.
Okay, that was pretty bad. I forgot about that one. That was pretty bad.
But the shots are quick enough to where it kind of works, but in no way are you fooled into imagining that this is a human being kicking and flailing. This is obviously a... you know, clothes with cotton stuffed in, you know, to vaguely make the shape of a human form. So.
I had forgotten about that one. Yeah, that was pretty bad. But my things were, okay, so you want to prevent the creature from freezing back into the ice to preserve itself, and you do that by blowing up the camp in Antarctica?
Absolutely, because they knew they weren't getting out of there. They accepted that. They said, "We have to do everything we can to make sure that this thing doesn't have anywhere to go." But that kind of doesn't make sense because...
Well, it's going to freeze when the fire goes out.
Or it could just run away from camp.
Exactly.
Out into the cold.
Blowing up the camp did not make sense.
Well, I guess if the creature wanted to be found, it would have to stay at camp, wouldn't it? It would have to. Because...
But the end result is always going to be, you're in Antarctica, you're frozen.
I guess they were just trying to, I mean, it's like burning the corpses. If the creature is hiding in the camp, the only thing to do is to burn the entire camp to make sure it dies.
But that didn't work either because there were two survivors, weren't there?
You know, okay, another nitpick.
Nitpick.
Okay, every time they set fire to this thing, every time they know, you know, except, okay, the first time you can forgive them, okay? But they know past a certain point that if you set fire to this thing, you keep letting it burn. You don't put it out. They always rush in with those freaking fire extinguishers and, put it out so we can look at it and give it time to heal itself and come back to life.
Yeah.
No! The first time with the dog creatures, okay, they didn't know. I forgive them, but every time past that, they're all like, "Oh, put it out, it's on fire."
I always figured it was more along the lines of, "This is our only shelter, let's not go up in flames."
I'd be like, "Okay, you know what, we can pack some ice together, build a fire, you know, and survive long enough for, you know, build an igloo or something."
They said that their rescue team, if they didn't hear, their rescue team would be there in the spring.
That's right.
So they really couldn't have survived by building an igloo outside.
So I guess the burning the camp was an act of desperation.
Yes.
I mean, I can see that. Desperation. Cause that past a certain point, you just gotta go, we gotta give it everything we got and try as best as we can because we don't have much left here. So if you only have one bullet left in your gun, you're not gonna not shoot it just because it's only one bullet. You're gonna shoot it, even if there's very little chance it's gonna do any good.
Right.
So I think it's a great ending to the movie. Plus, they needed that burnt up set to film the Norwegian camp later. They used the burnt remains of the American.
I see.
To, you know, and then they went and filled the exterior shots for the Norwegian thing, and it was the same freaking thing. That's why they look so similar.
Gotcha. And as a computer guy, I cannot forgive MacReady for pouring a glass of Jim Beam into his chest computer.
Oh, I know. And that female voice, wow, that was some really well synthesized voice, wasn't it, for 1982?
And that
how could they have graphics like that but have this voice that's just like, checkmate? You know, she's just got this sultry, bitchy voice to her. And
that was the director's wife, actually.
Oh, really? I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, Mr. Carpenter. I did not mean that. But, I mean, that was the kind of tone she lent to her voice, that mm-hmm. she was kind of, you know. I just kind of, you know, took it as read that the voice wasn't. I always told myself when I watched this movie as a kid that the voice wasn't literally coming from the computer. It was just MacReady's impression of the personality of this computer. He was, I imagine him having women troubles, and he was down there in Antarctica to get away from whatever her name was, to forget, to just drink his Jim Beam, fly a freaking helicopter now and then when they need it, and to play chess, but still, her attitude haunts him at the computer, and he talks to his computer by the name of his old flame, and that he's hearing her voice. So that's how I rationalize that little bit of silliness. But what was that computer? I mean, what computer has like circuit boards that you access through a? I know they had to have somewhere to pour the drink.
Well, you're talking about 1982. It could have been some kind of, I don't know. It's probably just something that somebody threw together just to play chess, I guess.
It was the bitchiest Apple IIe ever.
I know.
Now,
end of the movie. Best one-liner of the whole movie. Yeah, fuck you too!
Yeah.
Throws the dynamite at the thing.
What do you think about how they ended the movie with the ambiguity of, well, if we have any surprises for each other, I guess we're not in much of a state to do anything about it. So they decide to just sit back, sip some Jim Beam or whatever it was, and see what happens.
Mm-hmm. And Childs and MacReady, Kurt Russell and Keith David, did not know. They personally did not know which one of them ended up being the thing at the end.
Or if either of them were the thing.
Right.
And also the crew and the director and the cast members were wondering to each other in this ongoing conversation as they approached the end of the movie, deciding how to end it. MacReady came up with that ending, by the way, with him and Childs facing off and deciding to, you know, well, I guess we'll just wait and see what happens. Dun, dun, dun. You know, if a thing takes over you and emulates your brain and your thoughts and everything, once you've been taken over or replicated, whatever you call it, infected, do you know you're a thing?
Yeah, I was just about to bring that up, actually.
Or is part of your disguise being unaware? Because sometimes the first guy that busts out, who's all like, you know, feeling that pain in his chest as he's looking out the window. I can't mm-hmm. remember his name, but he's the one that the dog sees, and you only see his silhouette on the door. Mm-hmm. Earlier scene, he didn't seem to know. I don't think they know until it's time to whip everything out. I think that's part of their deep cover, that they are willfully ignorant. It just kind of shuts off.
That is entirely possible.
So either one of them could be. But I like to believe they were both human. I like to. And interestingly enough...
No. MacReady was a thing all along. Throughout the entire length of the movie, I know it.
His clothes were ripped up. But, of course, he didn't, you know, his face didn't melt off and he didn't attack anybody. So maybe that was, like, super, super deep cover.
Yeah.
It was the last-ditch effort to make sure that, you know, he got out there. At some point, I can't remember what year it was, early 2000s, they put out a PlayStation 2 game, I think, that was a sequel to this movie. And one of the places you could visit was where Childs and MacReady sat down together, and you see Childs sitting there, frozen. But MacReady's not there. And in the game, he's in the background, you know, behind the scenes, you know, as a character you discover later in the game. And it's got that interesting play of trying to keep your crew. You're just playing some new character, new characters that have found the camp, both camps, and are putting together everything that's been going on. You have to keep everybody reassured by sharing supplies. You know, here, take this first aid kit so that you will trust me, kind of thing.
Mm.
You got to manage everyone's paranoia. That was interesting. And Kurt Russell reprised his role for that video game. It's worth checking out if you can find it on, like, PlayStation Network or something.
I'll have to check that out, see if I can find it.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's The Thing, 1982.
Mm-hmm.
2011, we pretty much just covered the whole fucking movie. It is the thing that bothered me the most about the prequel is how closely it's like, hey, they did the same thing in the original. Hey, they did that same thing in the original. Oh my God, it's the same fucking movie.
You say that, but they tried really hard not to hit too close to home. They had one dog because they said, we can't have a kennel of dogs and have the same fucking thing happen. We can't do that. You know, and every turn they said, okay, is this too close to the movie? So there were definitely opportunities for them to really ram it home and just copy scene for scene, you know. But that wouldn't make sense because it's really the second half of the story. Well, the first half of the story. You know what I'm saying.
But more or less, going through the exact same thing.
Well, of course. It's the same situation. But they get around it by saying, okay, we can't have a blood test, so we got to think up of something new. So they come up with the idea of it can't replicate inanimate matter. You know,
it can't do metal.
Can't do fillings or implants, so those get cast aside, and that's a way to detect it. I thought that was ingenious.
You gotta shoot me because I floss?
Right. Yeah, I love that bit.
So there are subtle differences, but it's basically the same story.
Well, of course it is.
Because it is the same story told from a different perspective.
Right, that's right. It's the earlier half that we didn't see. And again, there are many callbacks to the original 1952 The Thing from Another World that they didn't get to do in the original 1982 movie, like the having a couple of women on the base, first thing, the big block of ice, you know, of course was in both, but that's pulled directly from the 50s film.
Right.
The insistence of the guy in charge saying, no, don't send out any communications. Nobody gets to know about this thing because we want all the credit. We don't want a bunch of people swooping in here and taking it away from us.
Right.
We made the discovery and we need to keep this hush hush. That was a big part of the 1952 movie.
Okay, now I really have to see this movie.
Yeah, so it's really, I was really thrilled to see that in the 2011 film.
Right. Motivation.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, and of course, tying in the two movies, the axe in the wall.
I love that bit. No, leave it.
Leave it. And then, of course, MacReady finds it, like when they visit the Norwegian camp.
Yeah, and the camera view is from the opposite side. You know, coming from the opposite way. I love those little callbacks, and that's why I kind of enjoy watching the 2011 film after The Thing, even though chronologically that doesn't work, but I like all those cool, moments where you see those callbacks to the 82 film.
Right, and of course you saw the actual two-headed merging. That is the corpse that they brought back to the camp in 1982.
And they had to work out, you know, it busts out the wall of the kitchen and then ends up, you know, in about the right position and facing the right way. So they had to work out where the kitchen had to be internally in the base for that to happen the way that they find it and match up with the original 82 movie. So that was a great attention to detail there.
Right. Now, motivation. In the 1982, the creature's motivation is replication and survival.
Mm-hmm.
It goes in, it's very stealthy, goes in, replicates, and goes to hide somewhere. Mm-hmm. Comes back fully replicated. In the prequel, it seems to be they made the decision, today's audience needs to be grossed out a little bit more. So it's kill, replicate, and whenever possible, let's gross out the audience by prolonging it. Like the whole thing with the thing crawling over and the merging of the two bodies that they find in the original one. Why would he do that in full view of everyone? When he could just run for it.
There is a little bit of, we've got to set things up so that things are the way we find them in the 82 movie.
I do understand that, but that's a scene where they could have made private.
Right, where nobody's seeing
it
happen.
But he's doing it in front of a dozen people.
And some of them have flamethrowers. You know,
exactly.
That doesn't make sense. But it's still thrilling from a movie perspective. And there is a tradition from the original, from the 82 movie, that if something happens where, you know, they don't want everything to be witnessed, so that if something happens that people are around to see, we see it. But if no one's around to witness it, except for the one person that you don't know who it is, and you just see a silhouette on the wall, you don't see it.
Right.
You know, so if they were going to show that at all, people have to be present to see it.
But
because if they just show it happening with nobody watching.
Yes, so many people. It almost goes back to the Howling with the 10-minute transformation and the woman's just standing there watching it. It's like,
that
why
is
aren't
true.
You doing something?
Keep in mind, though, that immediately preceding this, this creature split off into two or three different pieces. So they're fighting two or three of these things, and that thing goes, you know, and plus they're all in hiding, aren't they? They're hiding from the giant tentacle of death that keeps whipping out and impaling people through the chest. So it's not like they're all standing around just looking at this thing. They're ducking for cover. They're afraid for their lives, you know? It's not like they're just kind of standing, you know, just looking at it, slack-jawed. They're all like, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God, oh hell, oh fuck. You know, we're all going to die. You know, they're freaking out. So it has a moment to absorb some more genetic material. So that's how I explain it. Right. I think it was great. I loved that. I was like, oh, look, it's the double face thing. That's how that happens. And just imagine that happening to you. There is no horror greater than body horror, where something unspeakable is happening to you, and it's, you know, something is happening to somebody, a character on the screen, and it is changing them grotesquely.
Sidetrack a little bit. Have you ever seen any of the Hellraiser movies?
Please. Who are you talking to?
Okay. Hellraiser Bloodlines, the one where they're in space. The worst Cenobites ever are the twins. Yeah. They come apart, they stand on either side of their victim, and they slowly crush the victim between them.
Yeah, that is pretty gross.
I'm not even talking about gross. Why are you standing there?
Right.
Do something!
Yeah, well, creature effects are kind of like that, where the victims have to just kind of stay put. I do wish that they had the creature, nailing their feet to the floor or something, so they had some reason
or
not to move.
Stunning them somehow, yeah. It's like,
you know, paralyzing them, wrapping tentacles around them, and
yeah,
holding
them
in place.
Or something. But not just standing there. Okay, anyway.
Some shots, not so well thought out.
Right.
But
or sounded good at the time. But
the guy on the floor, he's been impaled through the stomach, and he's freaking out. And he is trying to get away. He is in pain, and he's scooting back away from this thing, but not fast enough.
Right.
So I think that was done well.
Okay. I don't think there's really any real need to go through storyline of 2011.
What did you think of the cast of the 2011 film?
I love the fact that they actually used Norwegian actors.
Yes. And you know something interesting about those Norwegian actors? Mm-hmm. There's not... there's not a Norwegian Hollywood. There is not, you know, more than a handful of really well-known Norwegian actors. And the advantage to this is that they always work together. They have starred in so many Norwegian films and TV shows together that they all know each other. And so they had this great camaraderie built in from the get-go. So
that's kind of like the cast of Harry Potter. Every time I see anything done by the BBC, hey, they were in Harry Potter. Hey, they were in Harry Potter. Hey, they were in Harry Potter. Well, England is a small country. And and the Harry Potter series demanded on only British actors.
Absolutely.
And it's like, well, we pretty much have to use every actor in Britain.
Pretty much. So you have a great ensemble cast there, and they all know each other. And
oh, yeah.
Except for maybe the kid actors. But they got
little thing there for, I know I keep mentioning Game of Thrones because it is a fucking awesome thing. Christopher Hivju, who was, what the hell was his name? It was a character. Jonas in the 2011 thing. Redhead, big bushy beard.
Always had
a surprised look on his face.
Uh-huh.
Is in Game of Thrones as Tormund Giantsbane, one of the wildlings.
Okay. Oh yeah, he is. Yeah, he is. I didn't put that together, but yeah, that's him. That's him.
Oh,
I
was watching it yesterday in preparation for the podcast. And I'm like, I know him from something else. What the hell is he in? Oh yeah, he's in Game of Thrones with the same surprise look on his face. Oh.
So good, bad, ugly. Was there anything ugly or bad in the 2011 film?
Well, let's face it, it's the thing. Everything in it was ugly, but it was supposed to be.
But anything ugly from a filmmaking standpoint? I love the cast.
I like both movies, honestly.
You know, one of my favorite things about the 2011 film, and this is going to sound really progressive and PC and everything, was that they had
the female protagonist.
Female protagonist and another female on the crew, crew of the Norwegian scientific station, and neither one of them were presented as love interests or sexual objects.
Very true.
They kept it very pure. They were just characters. You know, there was nothing sexualized about them. They didn't have the obligatory, ooh, this is this actress in her underwear, and somebody opens a door and surprises her because nothing but men around her. They didn't do any of that. And I love that. I love that. I'm glad that they kept that pure and didn't give in to that usual, you know, Hollywood BS where, you know.
And there was actually a good opportunity for a shower scene.
Mm-hmm. There was.
And they didn't take it. They took the high road, and we have to commend them on that.
Yeah.
Don't get me wrong.
We love the boobies.
But if it's not pertinent to the scene, it's great to see a female role not being sexualized.
It is. It is very good to see that. And I like that they didn't, you know, pretty them up too much. It was Antarctica. There's no reason for them to have lots of makeup and whatnot.
Right. And great hair or something like
that. You know, they were just, you know, members of the scientific team, and that's it. And I love that.
Mm-hmm. That was awesome. All right. So, a little note. The 1982 thing, has become a part of the culture of Antarctica.
Has it?
Yes, it is a long-standing tradition that all British Antarctic research stations to watch the thing as part of their midwinter feast and celebration held on June 21st.
Wow. Oh, that's cool. I hope they include the 2011 film in recent
years. Well, they might
years.
They might by now. I'm not sure how old that comment was on Internet Movie Database.
Wow. I had no idea.
So, yeah, that's a thing.
That's
about
cool.
The thing.
The thing and the other thing.
Okay, so what else can we say about the thing or the other thing? I liked both of them.
Like I said, I prefer watching them front to back.
Okay.
Because of the callbacks and the progression of the special effects technology. You know, where they tried to do...
Oh, wait. Speaking of special effects, uh-huh. Let's talk about 2011 going into the thing, going into the spaceship.
You know,
what
they
the
wanted
fuck
to...
was that Tetris looking
oh,
block?
I know, right?
They don't even explain what it is. It was pointless.
It was like an alien computer database. You know what? What
it was pointless.
That they talked about. Let me ask you: do you think that was its flying saucer, or do you think it just infected the crew?
I was actually always under the impression that whatever it was infected the original crew.
Me too, because
I
half
don't think
a creature
that,
like that build anything like that, you know?
Yeah.
Would you need to? You would just have to.
But in 1982, it was building a spaceship to escape.
Right, but remember, when it takes over something, when it absorbs something and
it
replicates
gets knowledge,
all the knowledge, and
right.
So it has the knowledge of who knows how many countless alien races.
True.
Out there, so.
So I've always been under the impression that it was a parasite that got aboard that ship. And
me too.
It's probably the reason it crashed.
Mm-hmm. You know what? Aliens are anti-vaxxers. The
yes,
bastards. They should.
Jackasses.
Oh, my God. See what happens? See what happens when
well, you
herd
know what?
Immunity goes down?
That vaccinating against alien parasites causes space autism.
You know what? There's no scientific evidence to support that. None whatsoever.
I know. We've done research on Alpha Centauri, and it's just, look.
It's anecdotal evidence at best, okay?
Lunar mind crabs exist, and it doesn't matter if you vax or not, you're going to fucking get them. Don't tell me you got mind crabs because you vaccinated.
Lunar mind crabs.
Okay. So can we say anything else about the thing and or the other thing?
Watch all three movies. Watch the original 1952 The Thing from Another World, and then kind of whichever way you want it, you know. I prefer watching the 82 film and then the 2011 film because I like all the callbacks, but I understand you like watching them in chronological order. With the 2011 and then the 1982 right. film, because it takes place after. So okay. Either way is fine. It's not going to ruin anything for you. Either way is enjoyable.
And here's a little tie-in. The original Thing from Another World and the 1982 thing, the title sequence was done mm-hmm. exactly the same way.
Yeah, that was a nice callback.
It was the words stenciled
mm-hmm.
and a light being shown through a... an aquarium covered with a plastic bag. The bag
like a
was
trash
then,
bag.
Right, with the trash bag. The trash bag was then set on fire.
Mm-hmm.
And the light shining through the burning plastic bag is what gives us the title. And that was done the same on both movies from what I read.
Yeah, it sure was. And it's a great practical effect. I mean, you don't get titles like that anymore. And the 2011 one had a fancy CGI title, you know. Yeah. But that's fine. You know, they need to show their stuff. But that was a great, simple way to do the title. I read that I heard in the voiceover thing, the commentary track, that the first time they did it, the bag didn't burn all the way, and they got ING, and that was it. So they had to do a couple of takes. Ing! And that was it, and it just kind of petered out. So.
All right. Watch all three movies. We endorse all three of them. Okay. So what are we doing next week? Next week, I believe, I wanted to go ahead and do a What Should People Watch for Halloween?
Oh, fantastic, fantastic. Well,
so we will compile our list of movies good for Halloween, not just about Halloween. They could be about Halloween.
Halloween-ish, you know, Halloween-ish. Just the right feel. And some of them not necessarily like gory or anything, but just spooky.
No, it doesn't have to be horror. But things that are fun for Halloween.
Absolutely.
Okay, so we'll do that next time. Our Halloween recommendation show. This will give people enough time to go on Netflix, go on Amazon, go to their local video store, whatever, and
local video store. Those don't exist anymore. What are you in the 90s?
Well, Best Buy, Walmart, wherever you're getting your videos from. I know Suncoast Motion Picture Company is done. I know that. Oh God, I miss that. I miss that.
You know, they still got a Blockbuster up and running in Alaska.
Really?
One of my favorite YouTubers, Corey Williams, also known as Mr. Safety. He does a channel called Dude Like Hella. He's been doing it since I think like 2005, 2006, and he vlogs like all the time. And in the past year, he's moved up to Alaska with his now wife.
And there's a Blockbuster.
And there's a Blockbuster up there, just randomly Blockbuster thing from the past, you know.
That's bizarre.
Very bizarre.
You know, it's probably just privately owned at this point.
Yeah.
Because Blockbuster itself has gone out of business.
Yeah, there's no franchise to support it, so I guess they just, you know,
kept the name.
They pay the franchise fee, and whatever company owns whatever was Blockbuster, you know, gets that fee, and they're like, okay, whatever.
I guess so. That makes sense, I suppose. Okay, so next time we will take a look at our Halloween picks with enough time for you to go out and get them.
Yeah.
All
right. That'll be interesting. Gosh.
Okay, so thank you for tuning in this week. This has been The Monster Club with Jethel Silverwing.
And Talk.
Talking about The Thing and The Other Thing.
And The Thing from Another World.
And The Thing from Another World. Which I will have to watch, and I will post my review of Thing from Another World at cinemaunrest.com.